Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Good evening, everyone out there in Podosphere land. I am Daniel Lackey, broadcasting from the very top of TV Mountain in Chicago, Illinois, and you are listening to TV Good Sleep Bad, the podcast which does naughty things to cult television that you really shouldn't, we really should not be telling you about. Joining me, as always, from the very bowels of Great Britain, is my co-host, Elwood Jones. How you doing, Elwood?
I'm good, but I'm not sure how I'm going to follow that one up.
You probably didn't even know Great Britain had bowels, did you?
Well, there's many places that could be described as the crud bucket of Southwest or whatnot, so... Yeah, it's the way the current political climate is going. You can pretty much take your pick of many places around here. So,
well, we'll be joining you in that for in about 2 weeks, I think. It'll be hilarious.
Yeah, when you become the United States of Smoldering Hole.
Yeah, basically. So, you know, right now I'm just making a run on canned goods and bottled water. And, you know, I'm planning on holding up here for a while. No, don't have any guns, though. Haven't been able to track any of those down.
I was just about to say that whenever I see, like, Trump gain some momentum, I just think of that line in Gremlins 2 with the brain gremlins in the stock market room. And he's like, I don't know about you, but we're kind of advising everyone to stock up on canned foods and shotguns about now.
Yeah. and that really kind of... It is, you know, it really does feel like Gremlins 2 around here sometimes, you know. I really want to kind of get to the point where Donald Trump just says that he wants, you know, he wants the, you know, the essentials, you know, civilization and, you know, guaranteed credit, even if he's been turned down before. And I'm pretty sure he's got like a little group of Gremlins behind him at his in his command room at Election Central screaming, buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell. Well, it's, yeah.
They've started comparing him to the Triceratops boss off Dinosaurs now.
Oh, dear.
I don't know if you've seen the video. They've done a side-by-side comparison, and it's scary the amount of statements that Trump have made that matches up with the Triceratops boss.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't seen that, no.
We'll try and put a little soundbite in here on our definitely send you. We'll send put the link down below so people can enjoy that one. But yeah, it's kind of like when we were comparing George Bush to chimps.
Oh, wow!
The comparison is that sort of scarily accurate. So
yikes!
Yeah,
you know Charlie Brooker's been doing the rounds with the press because you know Netflix dropped. Six new episodes of Black Mirror last week. And one of the things he's being asked about now is, you know, the final episode of the second series, the Waldo moment. He said, yeah, I initially thought I went a little bit too far there. And then Trump came along. He's playing pretty much entirely out of the Waldo playbook. That was just something where it's like, yeah.
But have you seen any of the new series of Black Mirror?
I have watched the first four episodes.
Okay. So you're ahead of me then.
Yeah, I've watched the first four episodes. They're pretty good. I think, like most people, I think it's the fourth one, the one with Mackenzie Davis from Halt and Catch Fire. She's in it, and Gugu Mbatha-Raw, I probably have mangled her name, who I'm sure has done things other than play Martha Jones's kid sister on Doctor Who. But to me, she's always going to be Martha Jones's kid sister, just basically because, you know, we had this discussion. I had this discussion recently, and, you know, they're doing the Iron Fist show. And they cast Vin Jones there. And, you know, the trivia question, we have this trivia question about who is playing Iron Fist and what is he best known for? And I basically said, well, I know what answer you want. You want Vin Jones is best known for playing Loras Tyrell on Game of Thrones. Yeah. To me, he is always going to be Santiago Jones because of that one episode of Sarah Jane Adventures that had Katie Manning as Joe Grant. And Vin Jones played her son, Santiago. So he appeared in an episode of Sarah Jane's alongside Elizabeth Slayton and Katie Manning and Matt Smith. He's stuck in that role forever.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way it goes for me. But yeah, anyway, to go back about three TV shows, yeah, the third episode, I think the third or fourth episode of the new series of Black Mirror, San Junipero, I think it's called. That's a really good one. I'm pretty impressed with it so far. I don't know if there's anything there that really hits as hard as anything from the original runs, but there's really only the problem with shock value is that you can really only hit a shock so many times.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily something you want to do with every episode anyway. So, but it's pretty good so far.
I'm not watching it so much for the short value, I think. About partway through the first episode of this new series. And I've only watched the first episode, so I can't really comment on anything else this season. Because it's kind of like a delicious meal. I want to take my time with it. I don't want to just gorge on it and like feel bloated and disgusted and wonder what I'm supposed to do next.
Right.
I want to take my time with it. And the stories are so enjoyable to watch one and then to go away and think about it. So the first episode where everything's based on your actions, people rate you, because we're now obviously in this society where everything has to be rated. You can't do anything without having some sort of rating. So I liked the idea that you're constantly trying to improve your rating because your rating is your status. And that by having a high status, it allowed you certain privileges that, like, you're able to live in a better neighborhood, you're able to have, like, first-class accommodation on flights and whatnot. And just watching these characters enter into this downward spiral is kind of like what Requiem for a Dream gives us. This pursuit of happiness and the inevitable downfall that comes with it.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of like it's kind of like Requiem for a Dream, except with Meow Meow Beans.
Yeah. I enjoyed what it was doing. I thought Bryce Dallas Howard was very good. And
by
being a Netflix-supported series now, rather than just through Channel 4, they obviously have the ability to bring in more named actors. Certainly, we've had the news since we recorded and since it's launched that Jodie Foster is going to be directing an episode of The Second Batch, which is coming out next year. So that's exciting because Jodie Foster is one of those female directors, much like Penelope Spheeris, who doesn't really get the credit she deserves. She's got a very good directorial eye, and while she's probably not known for her directing work and probably known more for her acting work, her directing body of work, I mean, like The Beaver, Little Man Tate, they're all fantastic films. So I'm really interested to see what she does with darker material. And especially what sort of story she's going to be choosing to tell. Because obviously with Black Mirror, we obviously, as long as it's based in technology, it's pretty much open range what you can do with it. And it's been interesting to obviously see from the trailer for this new series what sort of lies ahead. Mm-hmm. And to see that, we're not just rehashing something we've done in the previous seasons, even though we've now got like double the episodes just for this block alone. I'm excited to see what comes next. The internet's been very good and not spoiled anything for me, which I'm very pleased about, although I have had a lot of people say that they now can no longer use the internet because they've been traumatized by this show.
Well, I mean, it's still the problem, and that's, you know, typically the problem with the internet. I mean, I think I found out who died in the Walking Dead premiere within about 12 hours of it actually happening, not that I actually watch The Walking Dead, but
okay,
it's like, okay, you calm down, people. But yeah, people have been very good. They doesn't seem to have the fan base that the kind of fan base that The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones has, where they've got to go on the internet and they say, oh my god, did you see what character died now? So I don't know what to attribute that to.
I mean, obviously, Walking Dead, it's back. Over here, Ofcom received a whopping 7 complaints for the violent opening, which a lot of people have been saying they're shocked and they're disgusted and that they're not going to watch the show anymore. And I'm thinking this has been one of the most talked about scenes since the end of, well, coming up to the end of the previous season. So there's been numerous screenshots of the source material.
Yeah.
And there's been all this confirmation it's going to be this as gruesome as it is in the comic. And people are shocked with what they got. I like the fact that they changed it slightly from the source material.
Yeah.
Which was great because they sort of set it up that you thought you knew who was going to get killed. And then obviously someone else got bumped off before we had it going back to the source material. So I thought that was a nice switcheroo there. And
yeah, and that was, I haven't read the comic either, but I remember when this scene happened in the comics, and there was furor on my Facebook feed when this happened in the comics.
Yeah.
So I remembered that, and I said, there's no way that the Walking Dead showrunners are going to adapt this straight. They're going to kill that character at some point in some way, but it's not going to be, they're not going to just do it straight off the comics because everybody, you know, it's not necessarily everybody knows, but it's still, you know, something where you can go. It's not something you really want to go to.
Well, it's surprising. I mean, with something I've seen come out of the whole controversy surrounding this opening, is that I'm now seeing that there's been this divide in the horror community, especially within genre critics that have come out and said that they don't really view The Walking Dead and Scream Queens and American Horror Story as being the sort of horror that interests them because it's mainstream horror. And they rather focus their interest on like the independent scene or looking at old genre cinema from like the golden period for horror, sort of like 70s, 80s. And focus their attention there than this modern horror because it just feels too mainstream for them.
Right.
And I can understand what they're obviously saying when you see like, when you have people talk about The Walking Dead and stuff and they don't cite any of the history, they don't have any of the sort of knowledge. And I know it's something we've discussed on previous episodes of this show, the fact that you have people who say, oh, I love Walking Dead, but they don't know anything about Fulci, they don't know about Romero, they don't acknowledge the history of the genre. They just base all their knowledge on what happens on The Walking Dead. And it's kind of depressing. I mean, when you see people like Ryan Murphy basically running the genre into the ground and making it seem so horribly tacky and cliche. I watched about 5 seconds of Scream Queens that was on the other night, and I was like, this is just garbage. Yeah, this is being passed off as high horror. Much like he's trying to do with American Horror Story, which is fast becoming just an excuse just to show graphic violence and sex on a mainstream channel. It's not clever writing. There's nothing particularly interesting. We're just recycling cast members and giving us these awkward cycles where the audience is losing interest around the halfway point because Ryan Murphy can't tell a story.
Right. And that's, I mean, that's part of why I gave up on American Horror Story after the third season. Yeah. You know, it's just, he's incapable. He's very good. Ryan Murphy is very good at taking like an emotional set piece and putting it in a certain context. He's not very good at telling a story. And just about every single season that I've watched of the first 3 seasons, and I have no reason to believe that he's improved on this. Every single season of the first 3 seasons of American Horror Story just basically falls to bits at the end because he's not telling a story. He's eliciting reactions to what he does. You know, he's shocking, trying to shock the audiences with, you know, violence and, you know, titillation and shock twists. And ultimately he's selling a lot of steak and he's selling a lot of sizzle and not a lot of steak. Yeah. But on the other hand, there are people who have stuck with, you know, they've stuck with you know, American Horror Story. So I guess good for them if they're getting what they need to get out of it.
It's just not holding my interest. Unlike Westworld, Westworld is beyond anything that anyone expected. I think this is my new obsession.
That has been the reaction. It's an HBO show. I don't have HBO, so I have not seen it yet.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to start ruining Westworld for you, mainly because we're too early in it to be making assumptions and whatnot. But from the basis of a fan of the original material and comparing it to the series, it's been fantastic the fact that they took the framework of what Westworld is and expanded it the way that they now have the freedom to within the confines of a series. And it's been great, obviously, going into it expecting certain characters to be represented of characters from the film and then having that expectation shattered. There's a lot of great ideas floating around in it already. There's been some fantastic set pieces. The use of modern music, given an old-timey twist, has been pretty inspired. And all the characters at the moment have been, they all seem to be serving a purpose. There's no character who is there to provide just basically filler. And I mean, Anthony Hopkins in particular is probably one of my favorite characters on the show. And just his whole storyline as the architect of the park is proving to be fascinating to watch as he's playing at times like the doddery old man, like the John Hammond character. And then other times he'll twist it and like be the one who's clearly in full control of the situation.
Right.
Despite the money men behind the park trying to wrestle that control away from him. So yeah, Westworld at the moment, I can't recommend it enough. I'm really enjoying it. It's actually what I opted to watch over The Walking Dead opening. So,
There you go.
But yeah, I mean, here in the UK, we didn't really have that sort of issue because they have Walking Dead on Mondays and then Westworld's on Tuesdays. So they kind of do want to pit those two together against each other. And in a more random note, I did meet Anthony Hopkins recently because he's filming the new Transformers down here in Gosport. Yeah, they're up at the military base, and we hung outside with a bunch of other Transformers fans and watched the catering van, and he came out and said hello, and that was about it. He seemed like a nice guy. There's no deeper context this way. And if Westworld had started at this point, I probably would have bugged him for some insider information, but no. Yeah, I think the only thing that disappointed me was that he wasn't like Charlton Heston on Friends, where he was like eating a licorice whip or something. And I could have been like, oh, Anthony Hopkins eating a licorice whip. Who knew?
Eating a licorice whip with Anthony Hopkins.
that would have been it. But no, he came out and he said hello to everyone. Really, really nice. And posted photos with people. And I mean, what do you say? I mean, the man's a living legend. It's like you played Hannibal Lecter. And he'd be like, well, tell me something I don't know. So, yeah. Westworld, when you do get a chance to watch it, definitely do. I know, obviously,
it's
on HBO over there, so you have to pay people for that.
I have to pay extra. Now, I don't know exactly how I'm going to work all this. I haven't decided yet, because there's a couple of other shows, obviously, that I'm following. So I don't know if I want to wait until, next year. I don't know if I want to pick it up like a season, see if I can get like a season pass.
Yeah.
When it comes to Amazon, I'm sure it doesn't have, it's on a season pass now, but at this point I've actually got, other than Game of Thrones, a couple of HBO shows I'm watching. I'm obviously, as we discussed last episode, you got me hooked on Silicon Valley. So I may at some point just get like towards the end of the year, get a sign on to like HBO Go or HBO Now for a month, and binge Westworld and Silicon Valley, and then let that lapse, and then maybe do it again at some point. Anything else on your screen?
I've really entered into this bizarre anime kick. All of a sudden, I've think it's because we were watching Ueda 808, and it revitalized that need to watch anime. So on Crunchyroll, I've watched about the first four episodes of Is It Okay to Pick Up Girls in a Dungeon? Which is like this fun fantasy, which is, I believe it's only about 20 episodes long. I tend to aim for the ones which are quite short. So I've been watching that, and it's a lot of fun. It's interesting seeing this Dungeon Dragon style story. But at the same time, you have characters that when they kill monsters and stuff, they level up. So it's like they're playing Dungeon Dragons for real. So they have like stat points and things like that. At the same time, they have goddesses and gods that they can belong to. They have as like familiars, and who choose to support their like chosen champions. So I'm a little early into it to really sort of fully understand everything that's going on, but I'm enjoying it. It's lighthearted, it's fun. Because I'm finding that modern anime, the fan service is so unbelievably heavy, I actually dug up some old school anime and I thought, oh, I watched Fist of the North Star. You know, I remember enjoying that. And so I started that, and it's when I started, I realized there's 150 episodes of this show.
Yeah, that's what keeps me away from getting into a lot of anime. It's like, I don't know if I want to make a 100-episode commitment at this point.
Yeah. So, of 150 episodes, I'm currently 19 episodes in.
Okay.
And so, this one's going to be going on a while. But Fist of North Star, it's, for those not familiar, it's basically like an ultra-violent version of Kung Fu, the David Carradine series, which was originally going to be called The Warrior. It was developed by Bruce Lee, but the studio essentially stole his idea and gave it to David Carradine. And you basically follow this guy named Ken, who's like this super duper martial artist who has the Fist of the North Star style, and he's tracking down his arch rival who uses the South Star style. Basically, everyone he comes into contact with, he uses like Kiss the Dragon style precision to hit certain points and use like chi, and causes them usually to explode in bloody explosions. So it's kind of like Story of Ricky O in many ways.
Okay.
It's one I think I'm going to do on a future episode. I'm going to pick out an episode to watch just to see what you make of it. Because it is daft. And if you watch too many together, they can seem kind of samey. But, you know, with my morning coffee, it's kind of fun to watch. That, I believe, is it. I mean, we've just recently got Vice, the magazine Vice. They've launched their channel over here, Viceland. So I find myself watching a lot of, like, the Vice documentaries. And I only recently found out how much Vice is worth. I mean, do you want to just take a fun guess on how much Vice is worth?
I could make a guess that they're probably worth more than I would initially suspect.
Yeah, I thought they weren't worth much, but I was wrong.
I would put them probably in seven figures.
Okay.
That could be wildly... I have the feeling from the tone of your voice that that's a bit off. How much are they worth?
They're worth $1.4 billion.
Wow.
And this is the guys that write about doing drugs and using sperm as a euthyrogenerating cream. And if you read their books, they were saying in the early days, they basically just made everything up.
Right.
And they obviously evolved into this powerhouse alternate news outlet. And with Viceland being the latest sort of wing of this media little empire that they said. But no, I mean, 21st Century Fox own a percentage. Disney, more surprisingly, own a percentage of the company as well. But they're currently priced at about $1.4
billion. Wow.
That makes
sense. Yeah, I would... I knew that they were getting up there because I think they've even gotten to the point where, if I recall correctly, I know that they've even been in like narrative film production deals. I think they had a hand in I think they actually did have a hand in not the new Ty, the second most recent Ty West movie, The Sacrament. So it's just I have been tracking them for a while. And this does seem like they've the stock has risen quite high, really out of nowhere.
Well, I mean, despite the fact from the company's worth, I mean, it makes the CEO, Shane Smith, he's worth about $400 million.
Uh-huh.
And when we talk about these big money players, we never seem to mention this guy who owns what could easily be dismissed as being a trashy sort of poopy magazine to be worth right. that much. But then again, you look at the editor of Viz and that, he was well up there in the millions as well. So, yeah, there's money still to be made in trash. But no, yep. The channel Viceland is... There's been some fantastic documentaries on there about, like, the suicide forest in Japan.
Yeah.
They had... Ellen Page has done a great series called Gaycation, where she travels to different places and discusses about gay rights. The Eddie Huang has been doing a cooking show called Huang's World, which was great because he went to Gary Busey's son's little hangout, the Sausage Palace, and basically tore them a new one. He said, you know, you guys are just being fake. You know, you just want to take account of what you're doing. And he just like, he looked, Gary Busey's son, whose name I can't remember now, and I feel so
Is it Jake?
Jake.
Would this be Jake Busey?
Yeah, he just looks so sad. he's there and he's like got like the fat guy and like got these like women and the like there's all these like drugs and god knows what else carrying on there. They're doing the usual debauchery thing you've probably seen if you've looked at anything, any sort of like the fashion sort of mags and stuff, because they're constantly featured in there. And he just looks so sad when he got put in his place. But, yeah, Eddie Huang, or the human panda, as he likes to call himself. He's just a fascinating show. It's kind of similar to Man vs. Food. It's that enthusiasm for food that I like to see with my cooking shows. So. But is there anything else for yourself at all? Or?
We've been getting the beginning of the new television season here in America. So I've been, you know, checking a few things out here and there. Checked out Timeless. And which is a time travel show. Interestingly enough, one of the co-stars on it, one of the regular co-stars, is Patterson Joseph from your side of the pond.
Yeah, we seem to be losing everyone to your side of the pond itself.
Yeah. But yeah, Patterson Joseph, who there was a period of time when I was going through like British shows, and Patterson Joseph was like in everything. Okay. I remember him initially from the Neverwhere from back in the 90s, where he starred alongside a bunch of people who are now more famous than they were at the time, people like Peter Capaldi and Laura Fraser.
Yeah.
And that was where I first noticed him. And then, like I said, there was a period of time like the late 2000s, early 2010s, where he did a show called Boy Meets Girl. He was a supporting player on that, which was a miniseries about a body swap between Martin Freeman and I think Rachel Griffiths or Rachel Sterling. I can never remember them properly.
Okay.
And then from there, they did the Survivors revival. He was on that. He played Greg. And then didn't hear much from him for a while. He did Jekyll, obviously, with James Nesbitt. And didn't hear from him a while. And then he popped up on The Leftovers on HBO with just about everybody in the universe was in on that one. Everybody from Justin Theroux to Liv Tyler to Christopher Eccleston was in The Leftovers. So now he's moved to this, and Timeless is interesting so far, but it hasn't really given me its killer episode yet, the one that's going to keep me watching beyond the first season. The same thing applies to the new, pardon me, Kiefer Sutherland show, Designated Survivor. That's pretty interesting so far, but I don't know if it's really, really hooked me. I have been trying to watch And I've been having problems all week at my apartment. I switched internet providers, and then they were doing renovations on the apartment next to me, and then they said they had to do renovations on my apartment. So I have not gotten the pilot episode of Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency watched yet. That's based on the Douglas Adams novel, obviously, with apparently Max Landis as showrunner. I don't recognize the name of the guy that plays Dirk, but the main actor in the show, the main famous guy in the cast, is Elijah Wood.
It's a series that we've not had any sort of announcement of it coming over here yet, and it's a little frustrating because obviously Elijah Wood is like in my top actor category of people I'm just very excited about his career path at the moment. And everything I see him in, such as like Grand Piano or the remake Maniac, just makes me all the more keen to see what he does next. And
yeah,
he's currently going back and forth between doing TV and films, because obviously he was doing Wilfred as well,
right? The American version of Wilfred.
Yeah. So I'm kind of interested to see what he does with Dirk Gently, definitely.
Yeah. And I'm a Douglas Adams super fan, so I was a little bit skeptical because I'm not entirely sure about Max Landis, but I haven't finished the pilot episode yet, so that's the verdict's still out on that one. The main thing that I've taken up at this point is I think it was earlier this week, or maybe it was late last week, they Showtime released a teaser for the Twin Peaks revival.
Okay.
With a lot of, I'm not really showing a whole lot of anything revelatory, or even, I don't even think any interviews with like Mark Frost or David Lynch, but basically just a lot of interviews with a lot of the cast members, you know, both from the original show and the continuation. So there, you know, Kyle MacLachlan, Dana Ashbrook, James Marshall, and then some of the new members of the cast, like Jim Belushi, talking about it. And that kind of stoked a lot of interest in that. So I have never actually seen the full run of Twin Peaks. So I finally started that on Netflix. It's a little bit, it's really interesting because it obviously being kind of like what it is, and coming from the era it is, there's a certain amount of adjustment that you kind of have to do. So it moves a lot slower than I remember shows from the time moving. And yeah, it's got this really weird tone to it where it'll get dark and it'll be dark. And just in the middle of the pilot episode, they'll throw the scene where Cheryl and Fenn freaks out the Norwegian investors. You got this scene with this woman saying, "The Norwegians are leaving! The Norwegians are leaving!" You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's very David Lynch. It's interesting.
Yeah. The thing with it is that you have to, like any David Lynch film, you have to basically focus on the key points and ignore the creative fluff that's happening around it. It's so hard to like to talk about the show without spoiling what lies ahead.
Right.
But no, a lot of the rules are there, such as for David Lynch films, such as if you see a red light, it means something important is going to be said. So it's going to be a key thing. Same as if it's, you know, like, it's like a red room or red light, it symbolizes something important is going to happen. So yeah, I like it. It's just one of those shows that I just really like, and I think it, once you get it, and it may require like a second viewing, and certainly the first season is better than the second. There's just so many little moments I like throughout it. Such as when he's giving his little sermons on giving yourself a present every day.
Yeah.
Those little monologues that Agent Dell just gives. I just like them. And some of the characters I don't think have aged well with the series.
Yeah.
And some of it goes a little too off the wall to it's to the detriment of the series. But I understand why its appeal's lasted so long, and I'm I'm excited for the return and hopefully having a conclusion to it all, really. That's why I need just one good conclusion. I don't need multiple seasons. I just need one good conclusion so we can put it to bed.
Right.
But, yeah.
But that's what I've been up to.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's the same for myself. I mean, the only thing that we haven't mentioned already is Jack and Ozzy's Road Trip, which is kind of shown on History Channel. It's a history show with Jack and Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, great.
Ozzy Osbourne. This is the thing that gets me. It turns out Ozzy Osbourne is a serious history nut.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised about it. I mean, just a little weird, interesting things about rock stars.
Yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily know. Like Phil Collins is another history buff and has actually written about a book about the Alamo. Or all the various members of the various LA punk and San Francisco punk rock scenes who also have like doctorate degrees in science. Like Dexter Holland, I think, is a microbiologist.
Yeah, he's an actual doctor.
Yeah.
Which blows my mind when you think of the Osbourne, the bratty skater punks that they are. To actually have the fact that he's also he's like a very switched on guy.
Yeah.
So
and my uncle, who is a punk rocker, and I actually thought of you. He posted a picture. It's like, I got to see my favorite band recently, and posts a picture of this gray haired guy, and I'm like, I'm not really up to date on my punk rockers. Is that like the guy from? I thought it was the guy from Social Distortion, but it was the guy from The Descendants. I'm like, oh, I know somebody who likes The Descendants, and I guess there's like a couple of other people like in that kind of like the SoCal or MidCal that also have like advanced degrees in the sciences. And my uncle is a punk rock guy who's also a microbiologist. And he has that kind of connection to them, which is just really interesting.
Yeah, I think it was the lead singer of the Vandals on their website was offering free legal advice.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if he's actually passed the bar or not, but saying the legal advice was there, that I don't, and again, I'm not sure if they're still offering it there, but last time I checked on the site, they had the option there, so you could get free legal advice.
Yeah, the David Lowery, the lead singer of Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, I know he teaches law. He teaches copyright law, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Well, the other one that surprised me as well is that Skull, of Bulk and Skull on the Power Rangers, he's actually a professor of acting.
Oh.
So, he's actually another doctor. I'm not sure if he's a doctor or not, but I know he's a professor.
Uh-huh.
Who would have thought that the guy who played Skull on Power Rangers is a qualified acting teacher as well.
Yep. But, more you know.
Yeah, the series itself is basically Jack and Ozzy, they're going off visiting various historical sites of interest on this road trip, because they're both sober now. And they've been saying for years that they're going to do this road trip, so they go around and they visit like Mount Rushmore, and they went to Iron Mountain, which is the big data storage facility.
Yep.
And they found like the original recordings that he did for like Crazy Train that Sony have stored in there, and he's like these like the unengineered recordings and stuff. So it's been really fascinating.
The rough mixes.
And to obviously find out, as you said, that Phil Collins is like this leading authority on the Alamo.
Yeah.
And the fact he's friends with Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah.
As he as Ozzy points out, he's like, Phil Collins, he's a really nice guy, he is. So it's funny and informative at the same time, and I'm enjoying it.
That's cool.
And also, I found out in the episode I just watched that Ozzy is also friends with Dolly Parton.
That makes sense. That makes a certain kind of sense.
She video chatted him to wish him happy birthday, which I thought was nice of her. So, again, two people I would never put together, same as Eminem and Elton John being best friends.
Yeah.
So, because he was Eminem's sober companion when he got out.
He got out.
Uh-huh.
So, but, yeah, I mean, if that's it for, obviously, what we've been watching, it's been a pretty full schedule by,
yeah,
there, but, okay, on to our first selection for this evening. We're going to start with my pick for this episode, which is an episode from season 3 of the British comedy, Bottom. This is a spiritual sequel in many ways to The Young Ones, as it stars Adrian Emerson and Rick Mill teaming up once more to play these two crude perverts who basically live in a flat and view themselves... they're basically unemployed survivors, as Rick Mill describes their characters. And the whole series, all they do is come up with schemes to get sex or money while constantly engaging in these like violent, slapsticky situations, as they can take pretty much any situation and escalate it to the most ludicrous of situations. To episode we're obviously looking at tonight, this is the Halloween episode. It's called Terror. And in it, Eddie and Richie, over the course of the episode, they go trick-or-treating with a cattle prod. They try to throw a party in order to try and get laid, and it goes horribly wrong. And in failing to get laid, decide that they're going to sell themselves to the devil, while also engaging in consuming some very questionable sprouts. This, for myself, is one of my favourite episodes of the series, and the series itself was the show that my mother hated, which probably meant that it's the reason that myself and my brother loved it as much as we did. This show, in particular this episode, is just so funny and violent and really full-on slapstick. And I mean, this is the most anarchic of British comedy of this particular era. This obviously being in the early 90s. And the British comedy scene itself was viewed as being extremely punk as it had sort of come out the late 80s. So we had some of the cream of British comedy talent. We had French and Saunders. We had people like Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, all doing exciting projects. And obviously with Adrian Emerson and Rick Mell, they were really the ones right there on the fringe, and they remained throughout the whole of this sort of period, as they went from doing the show. They attempted to turn it into a film with Guesthouse Paradiso, which was horrible, and eventually just sort of ran its course as a series of stage shows. But like him, and this was your first experience with Bottom, am I right in saying?
Yes, it was. Now I remember, I've been aware of, as you say, the whole British punk comedy scene. I've been aware of that. For quite some time. MTV in the United States, once MTV started to kind of move away from like all music videos all the time, one of the things that it had imported was The Young Ones. So they ran The Young Ones and some of the comic strip, the longer form episodes as well. So that was my first kind of exposure to a lot of these individuals. At about that same time, a local PBS station started running, it acquired Blackadder. And that was, the same kind of group of comedians, you know, obviously not just Edmonton and Mail, but also like Chris Ryan, Alexi Sale, Jennifer Saunders, Dawn French, Fry and Laurie, Griff Rhys-Jones, Mel Smith, and so forth. And but I think actually probably I want to say that MTV must have been running the comic strip, then at least The Young Ones by 1985 or 1986, because I was aware of Alexi Sale by the time he did an episode of he did a Doctor Who serial, Revelation of the Daleks, and I remember being excited that he was on there. So I must have known about him by that point. And we ran, our PBS station got it really that season, Doctor Who, right after it aired in Britain. So I must have been aware of it by about like 85 or 86. But it was really like a lot of the stuff that they would show. I remember in particular, I remember them running a comic strip episode, a long form episode. I don't know if it was really a television movie, that was a parody of the I think the episode was called Forgo, Mad, and Dorset. I know it was a parody of, like, the Fabulous Four. I don't remember exactly what it's called, but, like, these you know, two boys, two girls, very much like a British sort of stuffy British children's lit type thing where they go on adventures and have a dog.
Yeah.
That type of thing. And you know, I was very aware of that kind of stuff and was really, you know, kind of familiar with that very kind of anarchistic, very punk rock attitude towards comedy. And I always paid attention to, like, I learned a lot of those names early on. I always paid attention if I watched something to look out for those names. In retrospect, it is really, really odd that somehow I have never seen Drop Dead Fred, which was Rick Miles' real attempt to kind of break into the American film scene. It has a bit of it flopped, if I recall correctly. That was the film, I believe, where he played Phoebe Cates' imaginary friend. But it's gained something of, like, a cult reputation, at least over here. And then also, like, still being clued in enough to, you know, recognize, you know, when Rick Mayall would show up, and I keep pronouncing his name different ways, so I apologize for that. But when he would show up, like, he was one of the ghosts in the Harry Potter movies. But no, Bottom is one of those, and incidentally, when it comes to Guest House Paradiso, Jay Kluwet tells me I absolutely have to see it, so...
Okay.
Two Brits enter, one Brit leaves. That's the way I look at it. But no, this was my, and I had basically heard about the kind of the follow-up show, the show that kind of exists in between the Young Ones and Bottom, a show called Filthy Rich and Cat Flap, which they had done, I think, with Nigel Planer, yeah. Neil the Hippie, and that which Ben Elton had also written. And then moving on to Bottom, I had just basically heard was that Bottom was about when it came down to, like, pushing the limits with what you can do on a television show. Bottom was really kind of the absolute limit of what people could handle. And I kind of knew it by reputation. I knew it was going to be crude. I knew it was going to be anarchistic. I knew that it was going to be insane. Amazon is selling these to the Prime, to the Prime. They're selling the streaming packages, season passes, for $5 a season. So I just bought the entire third season. Okay. It's like $5. So now Terror is the second episode. So I just started watching from the beginning of the season. So I watched the first episode of that series season first, which was the two characters. And I don't think you mentioned their full names. So I just really want to say this right out here, because this is just, to me, really sets you up for what you're in for here. Rick Mayall's character is named Richard Richard. I guess he's Richard Twat in the film, but he's Richard Richard here. And Adrian Edmonton's character's name is Edward Elizabeth Hitler.
Yeah.
So this is right up front. This is the sort of thing you know you're going to have to deal with. And I was not disappointed, I have to say. Just limiting myself to the Terror episode, these are people who basically, and this was the great thing about you put these two in particular together as a team, Mayall and Edmonton. These are people who had no shame. They would do anything for a laugh, and they would basically dig right down into your basest instincts to make you laugh. And there's just a point where they're coming up with these bizarre Halloween costumes, and Mayall's costume, I guess he's trying to dress as the devil. Yeah. And his costume is he standard, like, shirt and tie, no trousers. He has his shirt tucked into his briefs. We call them tidy whities or yeah. briefs over here in America. I think you call them Y fronts in Britain. Mm-hmm. And a pair of red fishnet tights.
It's pretty tragic. His outfit.
And Adrian Edmonton is dressed up as a Halloween banana. Why? Because they were out of pumpkins. And they have an electric kettle prod. Now, I don't exactly know why these two fellows need to possess an electric kettle prod, and they do. And it's not something that really has been engineered very well or built very well. And you really, the thing is, for Bottom, for a show called Bottom, a British show called Bottom, you're going to get a lot of toilet humor. And when anybody ever tries to actually activate, and when I say ever anyone, I mean the Rick Mayall character here, activate the electric kettle prod, it gives him such a shock that he simultaneously farts and lets forth a gout of diarrhea, apparently, and he keeps ruining his tights. So, yeah. But, I mean, there's just some, it is just, this is basically a show, like I said, it'll just go for your basest instincts. And this is, it's a show that makes me feel kind of guilty at just laughing at just such basically stupid stuff. But it's, I say that it's stupid, but it's, you know, you're dealing, you know, that to an extent that there is kind of like a level of satire here. It's not entirely, you know, just people doing dumb shit for a cheap laugh. This is really very calculated.
Oh yeah, it's very anarchic humor. The fact that, and it's on so many levels, which I think a lot of people dismissed it on, maybe because it is so filthy and juvenile in its humor at times. As you mentioned already, the first episode of this particular season, the whole episode is there, those two in a Ferris wheel, in which they're trapped to the top, and the Ferris wheel is scheduled to be demolished the next day.
Yeah.
So they can't go anywhere, and they spend 30 minutes going back and forth trying to figure out how to escape this Ferris wheel. They have various props that they bring into it. And again, with Terror, this is one of the few episodes where they use multiple locations, because obviously we have a large percentage is set in the grotty flat. Mm-hmm. And we also see them going trick-or-treating. As you mentioned already, Eddie is dressed as a banana. And to make it sound scary, he just goes, whoo!
Yeah.
And we also have this, like, trio of young kids dressed as devils, who, I think in the opening 5 minutes, managed to impale in a pitchfork in Eddie's crotch.
Yeah.
And the pair encounter these devils, like, later on, and embark on, like, one of the most ludicrous fight scenes that takes place behind a wall. So you don't actually see what's going on, but you hear all the noise.
Yeah.
And you've got various things popping over the top of the wall. And Eddie, like, pops over the wall, like, partway through the fight. And the rest of the audience goes, I think it's going rather well. And then it gets dragged back. And you see, like, an axe appear at one point and swing down, like, a random paper cut out. A sheep gets thrown up in the air. And it's sort of like, there's no reason for any of this. And yet it's so incredibly funny and you're just going along with it. That's the genius of it. That, and all the time when they're doing the back and forth and they're using, like, innuendo and just playing around with, like, English language. I mean, it's at the time it's like very playground humor, such as, like, oh, can I drink your juice? Or can I have your sausage? And these sort of euphemisms for sex acts and whatnot, which of course appeals to you when you're in school. And it was refreshing to see that now as an adult and supposedly older and wiser, the fact that I'm apparently still as juvenile in my humor as I was back then.
Yeah. And I mean, there are just so many classic bits in here that I remember at one point, I think it was the, you know, they had been, you know, Richard had tasked Eddie with making some fireworks and doing something with carrots. And, he produces a carrot that's had a little smile drawn on it. And I just lost it. I don't know what the hell it was. He said, little carrot with a little tiny smile drawn on it in felt tip. And I just lost it completely. And then it turns out that it is exploding carrot, that he's got a firecracker, like he's got gunpowder stuff in there. It's just like the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
It just goes so rapidly from plot to plot that I was kind of surprised at the end that once after the fight, the kids in the devil costumes didn't show up again. Because later on they get this whole thing where they decide they have to, Richard decides they have to summon the devil. They have to sell their souls to the devil to get laid. And, you know, there's a knock on the door after they do the ritual. And I thought to myself, it's going to be those bloody kids in the devil costumes. They're going to be the devil. And just this whole other thing with the what the hell was he trying to cook? Was Richard trying to cook? It was some sort of sprout, but he put like too much, like he put like curry powder and like Mexican sprouts, but he put like curry powder and other stuff. And then he has like a hangover cure that includes like dish, like dish washing soap and ant spray. And it's just so bizarre. But basically these overly spicy bean sprouts, I guess, whatever, end up, and as a kind of a result of this, Edmonton and Mayall have to spend the rest of the episode with kind of like Bunsen burners in the backs of their costumes, because every time, you know, they will literally fart, and like they will fart fire, they will fart like blue fire, methane fire, and I'm just sitting here. It's like, I don't like fart jokes. Why am I laughing? Why is this so hilarious? And it's just, it's something that just basically crawls inside you and finds that five-year-old in you.
Yeah.
You know, the five-year-old that thinks the toilet is funny. And it really just kind of gets that. You know, but it's also got these other levels that it works on. Like this whole thing about them being, particularly Richard, being virgins and, you know, wanting to get there was this one bit in the previous episode where they're, again, the episode entirely takes place at the top of a Ferris wheel, and Eddie and Richard are talking about these birds they want to, you know, get with and have sex with, and they're pointing them down on the ground, and you know, Eddie is kind of like, okay, we want those two birds. Are you sure that one isn't the bloke? He's got a beard, and his name is Kevin. You know, it's the verbal humor, it's the situational humor, it's the social satire, it's the whole package, and it's really easy to kind of, in many ways, it's almost sort of like a live action, a British, like, almost like South Park in a way, where a lot of the humor is about how much can they get away with, but it also, and it is, has a tendency to be very juvenile humor, but on the other hand, they are working at something of an intelligent level if you know what to look for.
There's something in the timing, especially with the physical humor, which has obviously been a key element of Bottom, such as you have scenes where they're obviously farting fire and they keep setting the couch on fire. When Eddie just like, does he look so exasperated when Spud Gunn, these two layabouts that they sort of pal around with, you've got Spud Gunn and Dave Hedgehog.
Dave Hedgehog being played by, I want to point this out, Christopher Ryan, Mike the Cool Person from The Young Ones. He's also, for people who watch the new Doctor Who, he was also like the lead Santarin for a while until Strax became part of the regular thing, and that was Dan Starkey. But yeah, I never realized how short Chris Ryan was, but he's short.
And because he always wore shades in The Young Ones, that's why I never seemed to recognize him in anything.
Uh-huh.
The same as Neil the Hippie is another one that I never seemed to place. And I think it's because he constantly plays sort of smarter roles these days. Like Neil the Hippie was like his dumb role, and he just sort of plays smarter roles since then.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you have like a lot of these kind of actors that played stupid characters in that particular era of British comedy, not just Nigel Planer, but the two that I always miss them when I see them in anything. Tony Robinson, who played Baldrick, and Tim McInerney, who played like the various darlings throughout the run of Blackadder. And, you know, Tim McInerney was on Game of Thrones earlier this year. I didn't recognize him, but sorry for interrupting.
It's so hard to obviously talk about Bottom without obviously wanting to refer back to The Young Ones, because they are so similar in style. I feel Bottom's probably perhaps a little more anarchic than The Young Ones. The Young Ones actually pause for breath occasionally, but with Bottom, it's just like you're watching these two guys basically destroy each other every episode. I mean, by the end of the episode, we've got, Dave Hedgehog has been blown up by flaming farts. Eddie has slid his wrist and hit a vein and spraying blood everywhere. I don't know, even the amount of times I've seen that gag where the couch is set on fire, and it's still funny to me. And the way that Ed Edmondson is just so exasperated by the fact that he's finished putting out the couch and it's just ablaze again.
Yeah, Spud Gunn ends up setting it on fire again.
Yeah, and the fact that they want to make a pentagram, but they've got no chalk or any materials, so they're there with the Ladybird Guide to Witchcraft in a pentagram of pens.
Yeah, I remember it's like we don't have, we need to make a pentagram, but we don't have any pens. Well, we've got pencils. You know, it's just, oh my god.
And the fact that they have no satanic robes, so they're all in bath, they're all in dressing gowns. And none of them match. This to add to the ludicrousness of the scene. And they're there with this homebrew that they've brewed for all of 45 minutes, yet it's reached consistency where it's melting the cups.
So it's like, that's not beer. That's the stuff they use to get rid of Crazy Eight's corpse in Breaking Bad, for crying out loud. You know, I just love that. It's like, is it lager or bitter? It's like, I don't know, but it's dissolving the cups.
Yeah, and the fact that we've got Eddie and Richard, the whole idea of trick-or-treating is to go around and beat people up so they can get money for their supposed shagathon. And we hear him talking about beating this old woman up with a cricket bat, and the fact she's giving him apples with razor blades in, and Richie marks it down as being like a tradition of the holiday.
Yeah,
trying to place why Bottom is so great as it is, it's so hard to like place why it is that this series works so well and why it's still so funny. It shouldn't be this funny to watch fart jokes. As an adult, I should have grown out of this, but to watch two guys beat each other up, engage in like a hyper-violent version of Laurel and Hardy, just with foul language and added filth, there's just something that's so appealing about it. And I think when it comes to this sort of humor, I think that A. Damonson and Eric Mell did it best. Obviously, A. Damonson opted to take a break from doing these shows and pursue his music instead. And there's always rumours that they would do a 4 series, even though the BBC rejected it, that they were going to get back together and like either do a 4 season of Bottom or have these characters in like a retirement home playing just filthy old men.
Yeah.
There always seemed to be this feeling that they were going to come back and do it together. But when they were together, they were, even though they went off and did other things, like Rick Mell went off and did, I think it was like New Statesman.
Yeah.
And Abe Edmondson did a number of sort of low-rank comedy projects, but he was mainly sort of music he was focused on. But they were always at their best when they were together. Even if it's like with other people, with things like such as like Four Men in a Car, which they were doing like with the comic strip, or if you were like looking at things like The Young Ones there. There's just something about the comedic chemistry between these two, which is just they just never seemed to fail. They were just always on point. And I think this is a prime episode. If you only watched one episode of Bottom, I would say either this one or the episode which came before it, where they're on the Ferris wheel, which I believe is called Hole.
Something like that, yeah.
If only just for the scene where they tried to create a flair. Which I'm not going to tell anymore, because it's just, when you watch that, it just ruins what is already a great show. But just to watch them try and escape this Ferris wheel and to come up with a plan to create a flair, which goes predictably horribly wrong. It's a show which I still find funny, and I think I'm going to continue to return to it. It's nice to revisit and know it's not lost anything.
Just the bit where Adrian Edmund takes his spare glass of beer out of his trench coat pocket.
Oh, it's an emergency pint.
It's an emergency pint! And I'm like, oh my god! You know, like, I don't know, just things taken out of pockets has always been, you know, back when I was a kid, we had the Leisure Suit Larry games. There's this one scene in one of the Leisure Suit Larry games where Leisure Suit Larry takes, like, a cardboard, wax cardboard cup of soda that is larger than he is, and puts it in the pocket of his leisure suit. And I could have just sat there all frigging night and watched that. It's just, there's a lot of things within Bottom that just really hit kind of my buttons, what I kind of look for in comedy. It's very surreal. It's it has its own internal logic, but it's very surreal. It's very fast paced. It moves from point to point very quickly. Lee. Edmonton and Mail have very, very strong chemistry with each other, perfect timing with each other. I remember having this discussion a long time ago with a friend about the Three Stooges. And the question was, why have the Three Stooges is not even remotely the apex of sophisticated comedy from that era, but why have the Three Stooges, why have their popularity endured? And a lot of it is because they had that chemistry going back to when they were a vaudeville act. And a lot of it is, the other thing is the physical comedy, the facial expressions. I mean, Mayo and Edmonton have these wonderful rubber faces. And I could literally just watch the two of them pull silly expressions for half an hour.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as it stands, Eddie Hitler is a funny facial expression most of the time. You know, he's not even, I mean, I would never have connected him with Vivian from The Young Ones if I didn't know.
Even though they share a lot of similarities. I mean, both psychotic. They're both charismatic leaders of their own little groups. Obviously, Vivian had his medical student followers.
Yeah.
Eddie has Bug Gunn and Dave Hedgehog.
Yeah.
As I said, both are both prone to these bursts of psychotic rage.
And you notice that, you know, fundamentally, and there's not a whole lot of difference between Rick, the character from The Young Ones, or whoever, I think it was Rick was the name of his character from The Young Ones, and Richard here. Again, they are kind of people who have just horrifically, they are like the most self-deluded people in the world. There is absolutely no match between the people they are and the people they believe themselves to be.
Yeah.
You know, they're not charismatic. They're not suave or sophisticated or any of these things. And they just have these horrifically unjustified high opinions of himself. I just always remember the Rick Mayall, the running joke, the people's poet back from the young ones, and how he believed he was so important. And kind of the same thing here. You know, Richard wants to think of himself as the leader, and he probably is kind of the leader of this group. He basically browbeats them into doing what he wants at any given time. And it's just, he believes himself to be, you know, a charismatic and a natural leader, but he's a bully. He's an unpleasant bully. He's not as smart as he thinks he is. You know, I just, another kind of running joke, it's a subtle running joke throughout the two episodes I watch, is his inability to pronounce anything that isn't basic English. Like, he's trying to pronounce double entendre, and he's just mangling it. It's just, they're classic, and these are like the two kind of character types that these two actors became known for. You know, I mean, they identified with that so much that they become kind of like iconic. And I know that I'm going way up my own butt on this one. You know, I think you can credit that with the longevity. That, I mean, these are people who, they were incredibly sophisticated. I mean, I'm applying sophisticated, the adjective sophisticated, to an episode where people just basically fart blue methane fire. Okay. So I know I'm probably sound like I'm really, really just appeared at my own butt on this one, but it's like you had two people who knew how to play off of each other, how to play for an audience, and kind of know how to put their strengths together, and they knew what their strengths were. You know, they were very, very good physical comedians. They were very good verbal comedians. They had great comic timing. I mean, and there is a lot of juvenile humor here, but not going to defend it. I'm just going to sit here and laugh my ass off at it because this is one of the funniest things I've seen all year.
I'm so glad. You never know what way it's going to go if you expose people to bottom. And I don't know if you've seen the whole season yet, or the one you caught.
No.
Okay. Because the last episode of the season where they're basically reenacting, they're trying to make money by recreating shows and things. So they do a parody of 9½ Weeks called New Birds Go Upstairs to Eddie's Room.
Oh, God.
they do they try to do like a Kilroy Silk, which I guess would be like a Jeremy Kyle style show, okay. where they're asking the question, should traffic wardens be armed? And they tried to do a bit. Over here we had a humorous clip show presented by a guy called Jeremy Beadle, which would be like America's funniest videos. Right. And in here it's Jeremy Beadle's viciously hilarious domestic violence incidents. Where basically they're trying to do these like these You've Been Framed style sketches. So Eddie's like filming, is like cooking the stove, and he's like, "Oh, I just filled this flammable oil over myself," and then he gets a dart in the eye.
I'm just listening to your synopsis.
I know you're going to ruin the ending of this one.
No, say any more, because I'm looking forward to finishing this show.
This is
amazing stuff. I didn't think I wouldn't like it, though. I was pretty stoked for it.
Yeah.
As you would probably remember, my mouth, "Oh, yeah, we're doing Bottom," you know, last episode.
you've not even seen The Neighbor yet, played by Brian Glover.
Okay.
For those obviously not familiar with Brian Glover, he plays the prison warden in Alien 3.
Bald guy. He also another guy that I primarily know from Doctor Who. Big bald guy, very broad Yorkshire accent.
Yeah, he was also in a production of Midnight Summer Stream, which we watched in school. So I was really excited about that because, I'm getting to watch Brian Glover do Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And I really like Brian Glover, so the fact that he turns up as predictably their thuggish next door neighbor in an episode where they're trying to remove the pirate gas line that they put into his flat because the gas man's shown up. You got plenty to enjoy there if you've only just started. Yeah. And I'm kind of jealous of the fact that you obviously get to enjoy this all for the first time, so. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we'll be looking at our second selection for the evening, which is Kindred the Embraced.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
And we're back. You're still listening, obviously, to TV Goes to Sleep Bad. In the first half, we looked at the anarchic comedy stylings of Bottom. We're now moving on to our second selection of this evening, which is Kindred the Embraced, and this was selected by Lackey. Lackey, I mean, what made you want to look at the first episode of Kindred the Embraced?
I want to give a little bit of context here as to what about this. One of the things you probably figured out about, if not both of us, then at least me, if you've kind of listened to this sort of like watch this through line, the narrative of these 14 episodes of TV Good Sleep Bad, is that I am a gigantic dork. And one of the things I was really into, I was never into like Dungeons and Dragons role-playing games when I was in high school, but I got introduced to role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games, not like computer role-playing games. Although I did play a lot of like Bard's Tale and Wizardry and stuff when I was 14, but that's another story. Which I will tell you if they ever make a Bard's Tale TV show, which I hope they do. But anyway, so the game that was kind of like the gateway drug for me for tabletop role-playing games was a game called Vampire the Masquerade, which was basically Anne Rice the role-playing game. Instead of being horrific monsters, vampires were these sort of like romantic anti-heroes. The guy who created this game, Mark Reinhagen, basically created this whole sort of like secret society of vampires. They grouped together in quote unquote clans. So you would have like a clan of vampires that were basically like Lestat, and a clan that were like Nosferatu, and then like a clan that were like the vampires from the Lost Boys, and so forth. And this at this point, TSR, which was the company that had put out Dungeons & Dragons, was basically being mismanaged by a bunch of bean counters. And they, for several years, until they were eventually bought by the people who put out Magic the Gathering, basically they were kind of like the, you know, the kind of like the acid washed denim of role-playing games. Everybody who was cool in the gaming scene played Vampire the Masquerade. And Mark Reinhagen, the creator, managed to be, I think, one of two or three people who ever got rich from creating a role-playing game. And it was all through licensing deals. And the other thing that was really kind of big in the mid-90s were that you were going through another kind of like one of these cycles where vampires were big. This was at this point, 1996. I think this was also later on in the year. This was the year Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I can't remember whether it was 96 or 97, but you had another show around this era called Forever Night, which I might do for this eventually, which was about, it was basically kind of Angel before there was Angel. It was about a vampire cop who wanted to get his humanity back. And there was like an upsurge in popularity of the Anne Rice novels and the Interview with the Vampire movie came out at this time. So in 1996, Aaron Spelling's production company and Fox got together. They licensed a TV show based on Vampire the Masquerade, and it was called Kindred the Embraced. And it ran for about 8 episodes as a mid-season replacement in early 1996 before being canceled. There was a rumor, and I don't know if it's ever been entirely substantiated, but there was a rumor going on at the time that the Sci-Fi Network wanted to pick it up, but one of the lead actors, who we'll get into in a minute, had unexpectedly died in a motorcycle accident, and they didn't feel they could do the show without him. So to give you then a quick rundown of what's what and who's what Kindred the Embraced is, it takes place in San Francisco, contemporary to the era. So this is San Francisco, the mid-1990s. The show is about a police detective named Frank Kohanic, who's played by the original Soul Man himself, C. Thomas Howell. And he is investigating a San Francisco, basically a crime lord named Julian Luna, who's played by Mark Frankel. He's the guy that died in the motorcycle accident. And what he does not know at the beginning of the episode, but he learns by the end of the episode, is that Julian Luna is a vampire and is considered to be the prince, quote unquote, of the five, quote unquote, clans of vampires in San Francisco. I'm not going to get too much into what the clans are, because if I recall correctly from the original show, they don't really, they're just basically kind of social groupings of vampires. But basically, this is sort of like a supernatural soap opera version of The Godfather. Julian Luna, he's a crime lord. He's got all these dealings with crime, but he's also kind of like an upper crust, like high society figure. His main rival is a fellow by the name of Eddie Fiore, who is played by the always awesome Brian Thompson, who leads a clan called Bruja, who are kind of like your Tommy Gunn-style 1920s Al Capone-type gangsters, to the point where they even use Tommy guns. What sets this whole thing off is that Frank, the cop, is having an affair with someone that he knows is connected to Julian Luna, but what he doesn't know is she's a vampire. So what this episode kind of does is that it basically sets up the whole society of vampires, the secret society of vampires, on the one hand, while also kind of giving you, through the character of Frank, a kind of introduction, the kind of using that as the kind of introduction to the plot. So there really isn't a whole lot of plot development in this episode. And it's the pilot. You know, so you really don't expect that. The pilots are almost all about putting the chess pieces into the right places for play. But it starts off a number of plots, like vampires are supposed to keep themselves secret from humans. They call that the masquerade. Alexandra, who is Frank's girlfriend, who has a connection to Julian and going to be a lot of explaining and re-explaining things, she's breaking the laws of vampires just by, you know, being with Frank. And that's, you know, that's a taboo thing for her. There's all these sorts of kind of weird interdealings with the various characters. I am going to kind of put the exposition there and turn things over to you. So,
okay.
What are your feelings about this episode, which apparently has a title?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I love the fact that this episode is called The Original Saga, which is a weird thing to call a pilot episode. Like yourself, I played Vampire the Masquerade in college. It was one of those few D&D style games that I played. I mainly messed around with that, and I played the Palladium. But yeah, certainly the World of Darkness games. I believe it's now changed to something else. But I was familiar with Vampire the Masquerade, as that was one I played around with. I did a bit of Werewolf, the Apocalypse, and I did Hunt of the Reckoning as well. And I love this world that they're set in. As you said, this is a world where vampires and monsters exist, but they hide themselves within society, and as we said already, it's referred to as being the masquerade. Going into this episode and knowing, especially with the vampire side of things, it was kind of a thrill to recognize all these things that I'd seen from the game. So when you have people identify themselves as being part of Bruja or Gangrel or Nos Jafartu, and seeing these different groups and families being represented as they were in the game, in the series, it was really quite exciting to see. And I love the fact that the representatives of the Gangrel, who are obviously like the vampires who can turn themselves into animals, the sort of more feral ones. So they tend to, when you play the game, they tend to be more like gangbangers. So it made sense that they're obviously a biker gang in this one. And that they're basically like the hired thugs for the Bruja, who our main sort of head vampire is a member of the clan. And when he was first introduced, we see on his door he's got the etching of a werewolf face. And it made me think, was he a werewolf? But obviously he's not. Werewolves aren't in this episode. I don't know if they actually show up in the series at all. But it seemed like a weird etching to have on his door to have a connection to werewolves when he's very obviously a head vampire. So, but I liked what the show set up, this idea of this cop being suddenly finding himself in the middle of this situation where he not only discovers vampires exist, that his girlfriend is a vampire, and the fact that there's this war that's going on with the vampires essentially playing puppet master and pulling the strings of society to further their own causes. I think it can be certainly confusing if you're not familiar with the world that this is set in. I could obviously see that. So having the knowledge of obviously playing the games, a lot of it made a little more sense than if I was coming in cold. But no, I really enjoyed this. It was, even if it did try and cram in a lot into one sort of 45-minute episode, I'm not sure if it explains any more as it went on, because obviously there's only about 6 episodes in this series, so it's what sort of path did the series really take from here?
I don't remember. I remember watching the pilot in a couple episodes after that, and then I ended up dropping it, and I don't entirely remember why. It was pretty clear at the time that, again, you're talking the mid-90s, a network show, it was pretty clear that this was not going to be something that was going to stick around. I think I bailed after the third episode, and I knew some people who kind of stayed on after that. So I don't really know. I'm actually borrowing the box set from a friend of mine, the DVD box set. So I think I'm going to actually go through the episodes and you know, see where this went. I think they licensed specifically only Vampire, so I don't think they ever brought the other. One of the things about the World of Darkness is that the entire idea was that you would have all these sort of monsters or kind of character types that would get their own game, and they would all exist. They would have a standalone game, but they would all exist like in a larger world. So, you know, in the World of Darkness, you could just play Vampire, or you could just play Werewolf, or you could kind of play them together, kind of in this world where, you know, vampires and werewolves are basically at war with each other.
Yeah.
It is in many ways a product of its time. A lot of the stuff in there is very cheesy. I thought it had a very cheesy of its time score, and kind of like these little editing tricks. There's this little thing at the end where, the main character, the cop, like opens this locket, and there's this kind of like flashback to when his girlfriend, and actually like kind of shows it like little thing in the middle of the picture, and it's very kind of like cheesy. There are some not particularly good performances in here. I felt particularly the woman who played Alexandra, whose name I do not know and is not on the main IMDb page, but I felt she was I really didn't buy her. A lot of the criticisms I've read of the show really go towards the character of Frank, the cop, where a lot of people really did not like him, didn't think he was a particularly likable character. Or I remember reading one review actually today where basically said they would have liked the show a lot better if they just killed him off in the first episode and focused on Julian, because really Julian, a lot of people feel, was like kind of like the natural center, instead of being the antagonist. Should have been the protagonist of the series. And as much as I wish Mark Frankel would have just stuck to a frigging accent, because he keeps shifting. I guess he was from London, but he does try to do an American accent, but he never tries to do a consistent American accent. Sometimes he sounds like he's from the Midwest,
yeah.
And sometimes he sounds like he's from Boston, and sometimes he sounds like he's from London, and sometimes he sounds like he's from Australia. And I just really wish that they could have, you know, he could have kept on point with there. But there are some really good performances on this show. Brian Thompson, who I've been a fan of ever since The X-Files, where he played the bounty hunter, is kind of like, he does play a good kind of menacing tough guy. The great Belgian character actor Patrick Bichot, who went on after this, he was in The Pretender after this, but Patrick Bichot, he played on this show, he played Archon, who was Julian Luna's mentor. He put in very good performance with, you know, as little he is in here. And this, having a cast that's good like this really, really helps alleviate the big problem with the script, which is, my God, there is so much exposition in this. I honestly have to say, there was a lot of complaints at the time amongst the vampire fan base that they didn't stick too well to, like, they didn't stick to this thing in the game, or they didn't stick to that thing. They have five clans. There are actually 13 clans in the game. Why couldn't they put the other clans in there? And it's like, revisiting this episode, there is so much "as you know, Bob" type exposition in this episode where people constantly tell each other things that they should already know.
Yeah.
Like, and they're constantly announcing themselves as like, "We Bruja will kill all you gangrels," you know. as if somehow, and that, you know, these are things to, like, you know, point out to the character, to the audience, this person, Eddie, is a Bruja. I can't remember the name, Jimmy Ray or Stevie Ray is a Gangrel, even though in the episode, you know damn well, Eddie knows he's a Bruja and that Stevie Ray is a Gangrel, and he doesn't need to point this out to him every chance he gets, but you've got to kind of get this stuff in to the audience. The audience kind of has to know what's going on, because it does kind of use, these types, these clans, like say the Godfather uses the five families.
Yeah.
You know, so you have, like, there's just a lot of this really clunky dialogue.
Oh, unquestionably so. And it was bad enough with the families that we have without trying to cram all 13 in.
Yeah.
It was confusing enough at times to try and figure out, and it was something made me wonder if it went on, would more be explained? But no, in this first episode, they tried to give you the whole world in one go. You ended up with all these plot threads that you didn't really care about, such as Alexander's relationship with, like, the head vampire of the city. It was supposedly setting up this triangle between our main hero and her and this vampire, and it just never comes to anything. There's a lot of grandstanding and gesturing and that, but it ultimately never comes to anything particularly special. It's certainly a fascinating world, and it captures the spirit of the books, which I really like, and it made me want to go off and see more episodes of the series after this one had ended. But by God, if you were going into this cold, it'd be confusing as hell,
right?
To figure out who everyone is and what role they're playing, especially when you're throwing around the names of the vampire groups.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how will someone who has no experience in this supposed to know the difference between a Gangrel and a Bruja?
Right.
These are all very specific terms of the White Wolf game. These aren't traditional sort of vampire fiction classifications.
Right. The thing is that in the games, they're basically, like I said, they're vampire types from the games. And in the games, they represent certain specific, like I said earlier, where the Toreador are like your Lestat-type vampires, you know? They're kind of foppish. They're often artists. They're good-looking. They like to hang around with good-looking rich people who like paint and stuff like that. They're like your high society and so forth. And like your Bruja are sort of like your motorcycle, like your rebellious types who just rebel against anything that looks like authority, you know, and your Gangrel, your feral animalistic type vampires. And while I understand why they kind of have to limit these sorts of things to like the story being told, you know, and I do think it is kind of clever to say, okay, we're going to shift the Bruja clan into like 20 style gangsters, and the Gangrel into these sort of like biker gang.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that was on the one hand very clever, but it then takes remove kind of a step of what these types, what these, you know, names were actually used to describe. So all you really have is just a word Gangrel, which doesn't have any connection to anything, at least with Bruja, which is the Spanish word for witch. You can kind of figure out that if you know any Spanish. But it's like you have like these, they constantly throw around these terms like Ventru and Gangrel that you just really don't know. You know, a person who doesn't have any connection to the White Wolf thing doesn't have that. That is a nonsense word with no context.
Yeah.
And all you know is that these people who with long hair that seem to ride motorcycles are Gangrel, and that they're at war with the quote-unquote Bruja for some reason, you know. And that this is something where I actually think they probably should have simplified it even more, or at the very least not try to cram everything into a pilot episode that barely breaks an hour. I mean, I think it's an hour and 7 minutes, the episode I watched, and that was on the DVD set. I don't even know that for all I know, that might have just been like extended edition with additional scenes, or I don't remember whether it was running a 45-minute or 90-minute slot when it originally aired over here. So, but it is kind of, like I said, it has a lot of potential, I think. There's a lot of potential for some really interesting kind of storytelling here. And it does seem to be a bit ahead of its time in that you... you do kind of have this idea of putting out a highly serialized series that basically uses these heavily supernatural elements that not even really kind of Buffy, you know, even Buffy, when Buffy came along, Buffy was very much, the structure of the Buffy season was very much around the lines of, you know, say an X-Files type show where you have your Monster of the Week type episodes, and you gradually kind of build towards kind of like a myth arc, and you resolve it in, you know, your season finale, where, like I said, this is just a lot more heavily, I call it a soap opera, and that's not just because of Aaron Spelling's involvement. You know, the best way to kind of describe this is someone called it like a cross between The Godfather and, you know, Melrose Place, but with vampires. And something like that, really, you know, it things that kind of like heavily serialized stories, you know, about supernatural creatures do eventually kind of catch on with things like True Blood. I don't think how you had to do a show in 1996 was really compatible with how the show needed to be made, which was kind of like a gradual kind of insinuation into this complex world that had been created, not just to start throwing around all these meaningless terms that you have no idea when you start throwing masquerade and conclave and all that.
Yeah.
I really have to wonder. I actually have to actually talk to my friend Robin, who I borrowed these DVDs from. Robin is not a gamer, and she was not the person I expected in my peer group to have a copy of this. And I really kind of wonder what obviously she liked it because she bought the DVDs, but I obviously have to kind of wonder what she made of this. Because I could very much imagine, having rewatched this episode, that if I had never played a vampire role-playing game, Vampire the Masquerade, I would have no clue as to what's going on. You know, even the X-Files kind of is as complex as the X-Files mythology and world-building gone. There's really not all that much development of the mythology, even in the first season. And this one, like as I've, both of us have said so far, just basically gives you a steaming pile of exposition and kind of expects you to sink or swim.
Yeah. I think the only final note I've got on this, and that's at the big finale, where Alexander is, having exposed our lead character to the existence of the Masquerade, is essentially sacrificed for her sins, and she's hanging around the Golden Gate Bridge, and she does this flaming swan dive, which it just ends up, while it looks really impressive when she's on top by the bridge, as soon as they cuts to her falling off, it's just very clearly a dummy that's been set on fire. And it kind of took something away from that whole scene.
Yeah.
But no, I enjoyed what I saw for the most part. I mean, it was a little confusing because of all the information it's trying to give me at the same time. I'd watch it again. I'd watch it again, see what happens next, even though it's kind of sad to know that you only got another 5 episodes left of the series, and you got the sense that it's not going to be wrapped up by the end of those episodes.
Right. But again, it's the sort of thing like you kind of do adjust your expectations when you're dealing with a show from this era.
Yeah.
Particularly with American shows where, you know, you just kind of, so much stuff gets made and so much stuff gets kind of left by the wayside. And, you know, it's particularly back then, the idea of wrapping up, the idea of really being able to wrap up a series in 8 episodes was just not the way you made television back then. And it's, I mean, for good and for ill. I think we really kind of get a good, this is a good show to really kind of use as an example of, this is why we don't do stuff like this anymore for this kind of format of show. This is why they didn't make this kind of thing at the time. And this is why, you know, much, much later, you know, years later, you have kind of like a different format for this, you know? So that's really all I've got to say about Kindred.
Cool. Right. And that brings us, I guess, the end of a show. Obviously, looking ahead to our next show, Lucky, what have we really got planned for the next one?
Oh, what have we got planned? We have something special planned. unless you live under a rock, you have probably heard by this point of a little show originally debuted on Channel 4 in England and made the hop to Netflix, and it's called Black Mirror. And for our next episode, we're going to be doing two episodes of Black Mirror to commemorate the new season of Black Mirror, which has dropped on Netflix. As we record this, I think that happened last week. So the episode I will be taking on is White Bear, and I will say nothing about this episode because all I'll say is that Michael Smiley's in it. That's all I'll say. I don't want to. If you've never seen this episode, it is, you are in for an experience with a capital E.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. If you haven't seen Black Mirror, definitely check it out. Especially the first two seasons; they're just absolutely fantastic. They're all standalone stories, so you can watch them in any order you want. And as you probably heard, I mean, at the start of this episode alone, we've been raving about this show. So this is going to be a fun one, and for my episode, we're going to be looking at the very first episode of Black Mirror, which is called The National Anthem, but more on that next episode.
Yep.
But as always, I'd like to thank everyone for listening. If you haven't done already, please hit that subscribe button if you're listening to us on Podomatic or iTunes. Maybe leave us a rating or some nice words. It all helps. You can, as always, find us on Facebook, which is TV Good Sleep Bad. And we're on Twitter as well, which is at TV Good Sleep Bad. We are at the moment trying to do more with the Facebook page and Twitter feeds to try and put a little more on there than just our updates of when the show's coming out and whatnot. So definitely look in there and see all the sort of news updates and things we're trying to post on there and keep it a little more updated. But Lucky, in the meantime, have you got anything happening on your side that you want to talk about?
Oh, do I ever? Yes. So I have come out of my hibernation as a film writer. For people who've been keeping track at home, I took 6 months off. I was only supposed to take 2 months off writing about film. I took 6 months off to deal with some personal complications in my life, and that has got that resolved. Or I don't have that entirely resolved, but I think I have moved past the point where where all my emotional energy is being taken from something else, and I have nothing to spend on like watching and writing about film. So I have relaunched my website, which is now called Lackey Writes About Film, and can be found at lackeyonfilm.com and at Lackey on Film on Twitter. It just got a new name, new design, but I'm still looking at, the same types of movies I always was. I did a full write-up of my experience at Fantastic Fest. I watched a number of films at the recent Chicago Film International Film Festival, including the directorial debut of Alice Lowe, the British comic writer and actress who is one of the parties responsible for the glory that is Sightseers. And there's a couple of movies that I've watched that I'm going to be writing up. I have a review of a film referred to as the Iranian Babadook called Under the Shadow. Okay. And the next film that I'll be writing up is Ty West's Western, starring Ethan Hawke, John Travolta, Thaisa Farmiga of American Horror Story, and Karen Gillan of Doctor Who and Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's called Navalia Violence. So There is stuff going forward at my personal site, and I hope you guys all come on down to LackeyOnFilm.com and look at the other things that I look at. What else occupies my time when I'm not digging up obscure shows to inflict on Elwood here?
Cool. As for myself, it's still business as usual at From the Depths of DVD Hell, which always can be found at fromthedepthsofdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk. If you can't get enough of my dulcet tones on this podcast, you can hear me rant about cult cinema on the MBDS Showcase, or Bad Bad Direct Strange Showcase, and I'm also talking about video games over on Game Warp, as well as doing the retro reviews as always at thatmomentin.com, and we've also got the Buffy recaps, which are happening at this show's sponsor and associate and partner, channelsuperhero.com. So, yeah, as always, trying to keep busy. But until next time, thank you, obviously, for listening. Thank you again to my partner in crime, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Thank you.
And this is Elwood Jones, signing off another edition of TV Good, Sleep Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.